OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties, one county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in that home straight, trying to catch that bald spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7.30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Okay, you're very welcome along to this evening's football show. Very happy to say we have a name familiar to many of you, I'm sure. Paul McVeigh is joining us. He was a Northern Irish international. He started off at Spurs and then had seven great years at Norwich, not least in the Premier League. And he's making his way now in a more unusual way, I would say, than a lot of Premier League footballers. Paul, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure, Joe. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, in so much as anybody can. How are you finding things?
I'm doing well. I think that it's very interesting when you have a footballing mindset or an athlete mindset, or have had one over the years, that you know, you actually spend a lot of time in isolation away from people. So it's probably not as unusual what's happening for me anyway, that might be happening to a lot of people. But also because of the work I do now, and I'm sure we'll come on that later on, that you know, I work from home unless I'm out delivering events and speaking at different conferences. So it's actually quite normal for me to be working at home a lot of the time anyway. So yeah, it hasn't been too bad, but of course, obviously in the bigger picture, I just really want to get back to normal as soon as we can.
And where is home these days?
Belfast, sunny Belfast. Hopefully you can see that sun coming in through the... Honestly, it's such a beautiful day, such a lovely, lovely place, especially because having left Belfast when I was 16 to go and join Tottenham Hotspur. And in 1994, Belfast was a completely different place. You know, it was definitely in the middle of a civil war. It was, you know, been troubles for the last kind of 30, 40 years prior to that. And for me, it was normal growing up in that kind of time and those things going on. But since I moved home a year ago back from England and living back in Belfast, it's just such a vibrant, you know, really buzzing place to be, so I'm delighted to be home.
Clearly in the era in which you left, nobody from other parts of the world was making their way to Belfast. It wasn't really a destination for people to make new lives for themselves. Down here, obviously, in the Republic, I mean, the influx of people from all around the world has really added to the vibrancy and the diversity of the place. Has that hit Belfast? Is Belfast a diverse place in 2020?
Definitely in the city centre. There's every time you walk into the city centre, there, you know, you see so many different nationalities and mostly tourists. I've got to say, there's a lot of tourists, which is brilliant. Mm. And we're probably about 30, 40 years behind you guys down south in terms of, you know, even the whole American population that come over to find their ancestry that probably wouldn't have come to the north. And now they're starting to come and all of the other things that attract people to come to the north and Belfast, especially being the capital. It's just such a fantastic place. It offers so many things from the tourist side all the way through to, you know, the culinary, through to the history. And yeah, it's such a good place to be. But in terms of diversity, it adds so much, because I really believe having those 25 years in England, where whenever I left, there was pretty much one black guy in the whole of Belfast. And that took in all of the, you know, racial diversity across the entire city. Mm. And then whenever I've come back home again 25 years later, having spent all that time in England where it's so normal to have all these different nationalities and creeds and religions and ethnicities, and suddenly you come back home and there's so much more, you know, foreign students coming into the place who want to come to Belfast to study, as well as just the whole people who want to come and make a better life for themselves, because it's such a good quality of life in Belfast.
So if we talk about your career then over to Spurs at the age of 16, as you say, from what I've read in advance of talking to you, it's very much billed as a player who had to max out his abilities and kick and scream and prepare as best he could to make it. Is that how you see things? Like when you went over at 16, was it still very much odds against?
Yeah, I was. It's because I was always the smallest player in the team. So that was the starting point, where as soon as you have that, you know, it's really, really difficult to play against players who are sometimes twice your size. That even if you are technically okay, and I was only just somewhere in the middle. I was never the best. I was never the worst. But from a physical point of view, I used to get dominated, you know, in terms of the speed, the strength, the power. It was very, very tough to deal with that. But maybe as I got older, maybe I was only 18, 19, 20, and I started to develop my strength. And then I started to try and outsmart people as opposed to outmuscle them. And once you start bringing those kind of elements into the game, then it starts evening up, because I thought, well, the quality that I really had was my thought processes, my awareness, my ability to see a pass. So whenever you have that as more of your strengths, then the actual physicality and the athleticism plays less of a part.
What height were you?
I still am. 5'6".
You haven't started shrinking just yet?
Not yet. I'm keeping
5'6". Yeah, because I mean, I guess you would... In some ways, you would relate to like Wes Houlihan, who really was our best player here for much of the last decade, but had to really wait his turn and was kind of scandalously left out of the pitch or out of the team.
Yeah, and he's one of my best mates in football, because we had my last year together in 2010 at Norwich City. And whenever I rejoined Norwich a second time, Norwich were in League One, that had just been relegated from the Championship. So I was going back after my first 7 years spell there, went away for 2 years, came back for one more spell. And whenever I joined Norwich in 2009, we were playing with the likes of, as you say, Wes Houlihan. When I saw Wes in training or in games, I'm thinking, why are you in League One? You should be in the Premier League. And even now, looking back at my sort of playing days, in nearly 20 years of professional football, he's in my top three best ever players. Now that for me shows, and you're up against the likes of Teddy Sheringham and Davis Ginola, you know, and you're just thinking, this guy is unbelievable. So yeah, you're right. The size definitely had an impact, but of course, likes of Wes, his brain, his feet, his skills, his vision, his not even just his confidence, his leadership to take the ball at any stage, at any point in the game, that for me just like separates him on another level. Because, and when he had it, he just produced miracles every time, and that's why I think, you know, he had more ability in his little toe than I had my entire body. And it was only in the latter half of his career that he started to show the potential that actually I saw in him in 2009, because there's no way he should be playing in League One.
When I would go to Ireland games, I would just watch Wes. I wasn't watching the game, I was watching Wes. And all of the things you've talked about there, especially in an Irish team which struggled to knit passes together, were borne out so clearly. I mean, every player when they got the ball looked for Wes. And frankly, he demanded it as well. I'm almost bitter on his behalf that he didn't have a better career. I mean, he could have fitted into Barcelona, and I don't want to go overboard here. But he was of that ilk, and if he'd come through the ranks there and part of the squad there, they wouldn't have been looking to get rid of him, I don't suspect.
No, and listen, take away the fact that he's Irish, take that out of the equation, and then put him against any player in the world. And I'm not joking, if you put him up against, I don't know, just to come off the top of my head there, for some reason, David Beckham came in my head. Now, David Beckham was an outstanding player, an outstanding athlete. Wes Houlihan has so much more ability than David Beckham, because David Beckham was a great passer, but he couldn't do what Wes did. Okay, so Wes maybe not necessarily could do what David Beckham did, but I'm saying the ability that he had, it was like a super strength. So what I had a little bit of technique. Physically, it was okay. It wasn't the best, wasn't the worst. And when it came to kind of the vision and awareness around me, that's probably why I made a living out of the game. But someone like Wes was, if I was here, Wes is just on a completely other level. And that's what that, when you start seeing the difference in players, you think, well, yeah, as you say, if he played in Barcelona, he wouldn't have looked out of place. He might not get in the team, but he wouldn't have looked out of place, because it's his comfort and his ability to take the ball, to play the little passing. And probably like me, I shouldn't have played in England, because English game and the English style didn't suit me. Was kind of all you know, and was all I ever thought about. So but actually playing in other styles of football. Because once you start playing international football, playing European football, you start to see that not everybody plays the way they play in England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales. There's a completely different style out there. And people like me and Wes don't really suit the sort of the British and Irish game, really.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we agree on Wes. We can proceed now as firm friends. So if I was to characterize, you know, and this links into your career now as a keynote speaker, and it seems, you know, it's going very well for you. You became a proponent very early on of the psychology of the game. That's a key marker here in terms of you making it or not making it. How did you fall into that? Who gave you the book or who gave you the recommendation, or were you searching for that anyway? And what age were you?
It's a really difficult question to answer, Joe, to be honest. Whenever I think about it, it's a bit like, have you ever seen the Steve Jobs graduation speech from Stanford?
He talks about connecting the dots.
And connecting going backwards. And that's probably a better way to start this answer, because I'm not 100% sure, because I could say when I was 17, I was given a book by a really good friend of mine, and he was, you know, in his 30s at the time, and he basically had played semi-pro, so he kind of knew the world of football and knew more about life than I did. But he gave me a book by Tony Robbins, and I just read it as a, you know, 17-year-old kid, just come across to London, and kind of the blinkers were taken off, because I'm thinking the Belfast mindset that I had going across to London probably wasn't very helpful, because there was a bit of an inferiority complex in there. There was a bit of a, you know, don't get too big for your boots, always, you know, keep your, all of that kind of stuff that probably doesn't help you be aspirational. And so that could be one thing. But then I also remember having conversations with my dad, and he was saying, well, why don't you try visualization? Because he was just a really big fan of golf, and I used to watch Jack Nicklaus, and he'd heard that he did this visualization before every shot. So you could say potentially that was part of it as well. But then I would even go even further back. But whenever we were kids, I don't know if you remember those that set of books at the Britannica Encyclopedia, or Encyclopedia Britannica, that we had them on our bookshelves that my dad must have bought years ago. And he'd just get up one time and just walk over to the bookshelf, grab a book of any of the letters, sit down at the table and just start reading. And they'd be like, oh, come on over. Look at this. Isn't this fascinating? Where you can like just pick up this book, any book, read about anything, and isn't that fascinating? Whether it was about the stars or the moon or the distance or the speed of light, whatever it was his curiosity and fascination with learning. So at what stage does that play a part? Because I might have been given a book, you might have been given a book, but it might not have, you read it, might not have, you know, left your bookshelf. But even if you do read it and understand the messages, you might not have put it into practice as well. So there was an open-mindedness that I had that I don't really know where that came from.
Sure.
But the fact that I was given a book to read at 17, where probably most young professional footballers weren't reading 500-page books on personal development, it was probably unusual. But doing that completely changed the trajectory of where my career went, because instead of just going down this path, I suddenly started to think, okay, well, what can I start doing? What can I start controlling? What do I see my life look like in 5 years? What am I trying to achieve? How do I want to do it? And they're like such amazingly powerful questions that most kids, most teenagers aren't asking themselves. But as a result of reading that book, I was. And one of the things that I really wanted to do was I wanted to leave football injury free, because I could see even from an early age that it took a toll on people's bodies. And so whenever I was walking into the physio room at Spurs in about 1996, 97, and we have our club captain there, Gary Mabbott, who, you know, amazing player, lifted the FA Cup, he played 600-700 games for Spurs, which considering he was that big was a really incredible achievement. And suddenly he's in the physio room getting strapped up, getting his back cracked, getting his, you know, all the things you need to do for about 45 minutes just to get him out for training. I just remember thinking, God, I never want to be like, I never want to put my body through so much that I can barely able to walk as soon as I'm finished football. So one of the things I wanted to do was I wanted a football injury, finish football injury free. So having a conversation with my mum, and she said, oh, why don't you try some yoga? I was thinking, what, in a church hall with a bunch of middle-aged women? It's not really for me, to be honest, but I tried it again, that open-mindedness, and 25 years later, as a 42-year-old guy, I'm completely injury-free. And is that down to yoga? Is that down to being open-minded? I don't really know what the answer is.
Am I right in saying that the yoga mat was firmly at home for a long time, and then when it was brought to the club, it had an interesting introduction?
And a lot of abuse. Yeah. So this sort of leads into part of the things I talk about now, because there's so many things that people would like to do and probably never get around to doing it because they don't have the confidence, don't have the belief, or just don't feel kind of capable of doing something. And one of the things for me, as I was doing my yoga at home, I just got this stage whenever I just established myself in the Norwich team. I was playing, you know, regularly, I was scoring goals. And I decided to bring in my yoga mat into the training ground. And you can imagine 25 footballers looking at one guy bringing in his yoga mat. Suddenly, you know, as I went there for training and came back in, to look at my yoga mat, and so it's been cut up into a million pieces. And then I'm going to look at it the next time because I'm thinking there's no way I'm letting these guys get the better of me. So I went and got another one next day they brought in, and they actually burned it, put it, set it on fire. And I'm like, right, there's no way I'm letting them beat me. I'm not letting them beat me. And I went again, got another one. This time they brought it into the car park and started, like, you know, doing donuts and driving over it, completely ruined it. Until eventually I got this stage where I brought it in and no one touched it. Just they started throwing abuse at me instead of physically racking my stuff. So then I started doing the yoga in the side of the room next to the physio room. And I'm not joking, Joe, if I could, I wouldn't be able to tell you the insults that I got from doing yoga at a professional football club in the early 2000s. But eventually, as these things happen, because this is how, you know, society changes, this is how people change and things change and beliefs change. They went from that first step, which is just abuse, you know, it's just that violent opposition almost, to the second step of changing anything in society is questioning or curiosity. So why are you doing that yoga? Well, I'm doing it because it's going to help me feel better. So when I get out of training, I'm going to be in a better shape, better condition. And then after this happens for another couple of weeks, I'm in there by myself and a couple of other people poke their head in through the door until you get to the third stage of this, you know, process of change. And that's where it becomes acceptable or acceptance that people just want to go, oh, he's just in there doing his yoga. Why is he doing yoga? Well, because it's going to help him doing his football. So it's just normal to do.
Yeah. And down the road, Roy Keane and Ryan Giggs were already doing their yoga. And
No, they weren't. 10 years later, 15 years later, Roy Keane and Ryan Giggs started doing it.
Because I did it later.
Wow. Yeah. Because we're roughly the same age. So okay. Roy Keane, Giggs and myself are all in their 40s. And I'm suddenly 10 years, 15 years beforehand, and then I see Ryan Giggs brings out a DVD doing yoga. Yeah. I'm like, okay, that's what you can do. When you've won that many Premier League titles, and when you've only scored twice in the Premier League, it's a little bit of a different story.
He was the first I heard of doing it. I mean, that story you tell is just so typical of football and the herd mentality, a herd of independent minds, but all so closed off to exposing themselves to ridicule. I'm not surprised the head came around the door when you started doing it and there was a curiosity there, almost ashamed, but what are you doing? But I'm torn by, I don't want the group to come at me. And there's that famous book, The Five Regrets of the Dying by Bronnie Ware, the Australian palliative care nurse. And the biggest regret of the dying, and it's a book we should all be reading, is I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. That is the biggest regret people have on their deathbed. And that story, it's a simple story and it's not an important thing doing yoga, but their attitude captures that. Too many of them afraid for, I don't know what reason, to see can they maximize themselves.
Yeah, and again, you're right. It's the herd mentality because footballers are sheep. In fact, most people are sheep. Most people just do what everyone else is doing because everyone else is doing it. So it's like, if they're doing it, then that must be the way you do it. And again, it was something that I always thought I didn't like being put into this category of what footballers and the connotation of what footballers were and how they acted and their sort of their academic level. And whenever I just thought, well, I don't want to be the way that everyone expects me to be, so I'm just going to be me. And if that falls in that category, great. If it doesn't, then that's okay. So probably I, without reading that book, but I've seen those five lessons many times in the last 10 years or so. And that's something that I've been doing for a long time because effectively, in football, you need to be so narrow-minded and so focused just to get any kind of level of professionalism. And if you do that, you're giving yourself the tiniest opportunity. to become a proper professional footballer.
So the yoga then being a small example of an open mind and trying to maximize your talent. Talk to us about your psychology across your career. You leave Spurs. I think George Graham tells you you're probably not good enough to be a professional footballer.
Yeah, too small.
talk about old school. And then 215 appearances for Norwich later, you know, scoring a goal at Old Trafford, surviving in the Premier League for a period. You've clearly maximized what you had. Yoga's happening, but what about psychology? What's going on in your head? Like, are you, do you look back now and think that was your almost your greatest asset? Because I, when I'm watching in the stand, I can't judge of the 22 players who has mentally prepared well and who's just decided to stroll out there.
Yeah, and that's where it's so different. And I think this is why the whole world of psychology, especially sports psychology, still struggles in certain areas, definitely in sport. It's obviously why, you know, in terms of mental health as well, the difficulty with it is that it's very hard to measure. With everything else that we do, whether you're in a job at an office or you're a salesperson or you're talking about how fast you can run around a track, these are all really measurable, really easy to measure. As soon as you start talking about the things that are happening inside your head, you know, what psychometric is going to give you that ability to say, well, this is where you were, this is what you're like, well, that's an improvement or not. So that's the first aspect of why it's difficult. But I suppose what I had probably a philosophy of is that I'm going to try and do everything within my power that I feel is going to help me become a professional footballer and then to sustain that. But also, that's almost one side of what I was thinking. But then the other side is, I also want to have a life. As much as I want to be a professional footballer, as much as I want to play at the highest level, I want to enjoy my life. And so for a couple of years, I got to a point where, as you said, just being released from Spurs, George Graham told me I'm too small. And then I get to Norwich City and Nigel Worthington becomes the manager. And suddenly he tells me that I'm not good enough for the team. I'm thinking, wow, this is like my career is really going downhill here. And at that point, you start to you almost question everything. And I got to a point where I thought, well, because football is still my highest priority more than anything else in life, I'm going to act in a way or behave in a way that the only thing I'm going to do is things that are going to help me become a professional footballer. And by doing that, it was a way of asking myself every time before I did something, is this going to help me get in the first team or is it going to? But that is so obsessive, so focused, so, you know, relentless. That I did that for a while. Finally, I established myself in the Norwich team and playing 40 games a season, scoring 10 goals, really doing well. And then after a while, you start to think, okay, I need to almost like bring other things back into my life because otherwise you just become a robot. And that was less enjoyable, even though I was really still, you know, playing well and doing the things that I wanted to do in terms of the football side. But outside, I wasn't socializing with anybody. I wasn't drinking alcohol. I was stopping seeing different things, different people, different things. And I actually made a conscious decision when I was about 25 or 26. I thought, as much as I want to be a professional footballer and maximize my potential, I'm not prepared to give up everything in my life just to do that one thing. And so I decided, right, I'm going to start drinking alcohol again when it's appropriate, Saturday nights or whatever I'm doing. I still want to have those family times, friends, nights out. All the amount of friends that used to come over from Belfast every time, like 20, 25 people used to turn up in Norwich City at the training ground. It was chaos, but I loved it because you had your friends with you. They were seeing all of this and it would have killed me if I'd have been sitting there drinking a glass of water while they're out enjoying themselves. So it was the conscious decision that I made that, yep, I want to be a footballer, but I also still want to have all these different aspects of my life.
Were you going to see a sports psychologist? Did you have a routine on match day?
Routine was more just something that evolved over the years. I actually, again, going back to when I was at Spurs, I went to see a sports psychologist because I'd never seen one. And again, it's the stigma that still exists with seeing a sports psychologist. And funny, I did an interview because I was trying to raise some money for the NHS whenever in the last couple of months. And I was doing all these different interviews and spoke to Carl Frampton about sports psychology. And he said, you know, still in the world of boxing, if you see a sports psychologist, it's a bit like, you know, what's wrong with him? But whenever I was 16 or 17, when I went to see a sports psychologist, it was because I'm performing at whatever level I was at. And I was almost, how do I get better at what I'm doing? So that was my mindset or philosophy. How do I improve? If I see a sports psychologist, will that improve me? Okay, I'm going to go and do it. But most people only see a sports psychologist, or most people only see a psychologist when things have got to, you know, rock bottom or very, very low. And that's the stigma, where it's like that's completely approaching it from the wrong angle, as far as I can see.
So did you stick with the psychologist through your career?
I saw one whenever I was at Spurs for a while, and then when I went to Norwich, we had two different periods of seeing two different sports psychologists. And I think they were probably the reason why I ended up becoming a sports psychologist for the 2 years at Norwich City and 5 years at Crystal Palace, because they both fascinated me. The two guys, Keith Mincher and Gavin Drake, who, when we were working with them, I just used to love having conversations with them. I loved the way they carried themselves. I loved the way they kind of could handle questions and could come across in different sessions to be able to show that the way that you're doing it is not the only way. And some of the like really, really important lessons I learned from, well, if I pick Keith Mincher, first of all, he ended up working for England, and he came out with, it's actually one of the tenets from NLP. You heard of NLP, neurolinguistic program?
Yeah.
So it's not my favorite part of psychology, but I love this line, where he came out with the line of, there's no such thing as failure, only feedback. And I'd never heard that before. And I suddenly thought, wow, what a great belief or philosophy to adopt into your life. You never fail, you only just get some feedback of what that is. Now, if that's the feedback that you liked, brilliant, keep doing it. If that feedback wasn't what you liked, then maybe you need to change your approach so that you get a different outcome. But that's just a great line that I loved. And then whenever I came across Gavin Drake, and a little bit later in my career, and Gavin shared something with me called the thinking cycle. So, you know, 10 years after I came out of football, I'm still working with Gavin because he's had such a hugely positive and constructive impact on me in terms of my life. And he shared something with us whenever I was, I think, 27, called the thinking cycle. And all it is like, it's the simple way that humans function. So if you think about cognitive behavioral therapy, there's a very simple principle that how you think drives how you feel, and how you feel drives what you do in terms of your behaviors. But again, as a 27-year-old guy, I'd never come across this. But when you think about it, if you don't understand how humans across the world function, that might be an issue, because we're all doing it. So we're all thinking in ways all the time, and we're all going to be having different emotions and different emotional states. And if you realize that they are directly impacted on how you behave every single day, and of course what you do every single day, in my world, was called my performance. I was training matches, whether I get a contract, whether I don't. But how you behave every single day pretty much dictates what your life looks like. And yeah. I was thinking, I'd never known this before. And if you never knew how humans function, you know, how late do you need to get? You're talking about the nurse who's, you know, talking about the regrets of the dying. Well, imagine waiting until you're 60 or 70 or 80 until you finally understand and realize how humans function. It'd be better to understand earlier in life so that you can apply it to your own life.
Yeah. I think there's been a quantum leap in the last 10 years with the advent of podcasts, with the advent of YouTube, limitless bandwidth, and maybe just society maturing as well. There is so much information out there now. I think things like CBT are just in the lexicon. People are aware of it. I think kids learn about resilience, meditation, mindfulness in schools and beyond. Like, MIC mindfulness has become a thing. There are a lot of bad actors out there now, and they don't know what they're talking about, and they're just taking the same 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 recycled ideas and pumping them out there. I've reached a stage. So I've been fast. I'm 35, but like from a teenager, I was fascinated with all this stuff, read all this stuff. I am reaching a point now where I think it's been flooded with so much gimmickry and awfulness and fridge magnet wisdom. I'm starting to turn away from it all. I have to say I've had my fill of it, and I think there's just too much rubbish out there, you know, and very cynical as well. Talk to us about that, because this is an area where my threshold for listening to people has gone from I'm open to everything to I might just smell a rat the second I listen to someone talk now.
Yeah. Well, honestly, Joe, it's not for me to try and, promote anything to do with this world or try and sell it to anybody. I suppose the way that I would try and explain it is that if I'm standing up in front of, let's say, 100 people at a conference, just keep it nice and simple. And if I'm standing up and I'm asking a question of, you know, how many people in this room have goals or targets for the workplace? Pretty much everybody in the room has either some sort of KPIs, targets, objectives, something they need to be doing of whether it works. And okay, brilliant, put your hands there. Right? Now, please put your hand up if you have well thought out, well constructed, and this is generally the key or differential, written down goals or targets for your personal life. And I see when you ask that question, how many hands in general do you think go up?
Three.
Less than three. Three would be good. If I got three, I'd probably be happy. Might be a little jig in front of the room. Generally get none. Sometimes I get one, very occasionally I get two. Every now and again, I might get three. That's just as, haven't done this a long time now. That's the sort of general numbers. Now put that into perspective. Most people are putting so much time and effort into their work. You know, some people are working 36, 40, 50, 60, 70 hours a week. All this time and effort into their work. Put that into their personal life. So what are you doing this for? What are you working towards? What are you trying to achieve? What's your regrets before you get to the deathbed and looking back at your life and thinking, I wish I had done this, this, and this? Mm. Well, all I'm doing, and this is my kind of my individual philosophy, I love learning and especially love from people learning from people around me. So whenever I was 16, 17, seeing Gary Mabbitt on that physio room table, I was learning that I didn't want to end up like Gary Mabbitt. Not there's anything wrong with him, but the fact that I didn't want to have that. And then as I'm going through and I'm seeing these different people and having these different lessons, like people telling you're too small, you're not good enough and all the rest of it, until eventually it was a lesson of, well, I don't need to be listening to someone else to understand who I am, what I am and what I can bring to the table. Until eventually things like that, I talked about the thinking cycle, how your thoughts dictate how you feel and how you feel dictates what you do. Well, if I'm waiting for someone else to come along and make me happy in my life, well, let's just take psychology for a second. How you think drives how you feel. Happiness is an emotion, so you decide whether you're happy or not. So all of these lessons that I'm learning as I'm going through my life, I'm going, okay, well, let's think of something else. What are you actually working for? What is your version of success in life? How do you define success? Because, you know, you don't know my mum, but a 71-year-old woman living in Belfast around the corner, her version of success is very clear. She just wants her kids to be happy and healthy, same as her grandkids. But as we all have different versions of success in our life, I'm really, really clear. Whenever I was 16, I was just off a boat over to England, and I'm suddenly arriving at Tottenham Hotspur. My version of success was, I want to be a Premier League, and I want to be an international footballer. 16 years later, I leave professional football, and for the last 10 years, my new version of success, because it changes all the time, is about balance. Because I never had any balance in my life. It was all about work, 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 get the next game, next match, next training session. That's now going to the side. So what's my version of success? It's balance. So I don't want loads of money. I don't want to be working all the time. I don't want to be partying all the time. I don't want to be on holiday all the time, training all. I just want a bit of everything. But I've decided very clearly what I'm doing and why I do it. And when I ask 100 really high achievers in a room, because generally if they're in the room, it's because they're high achievers, why are you doing all this work for? And to throw one more stat at you really, really quickly. So it won't apply to Ireland, but it will be for the UK because that's where I was living for all those years. But Gallup are a huge American company that survey sort of governmentally and sort of huge statistics. And they basically worked out there's about 30 million people go to work every single week in the UK. And they said out of those 30 million people, down one end of the spectrum, there's about 10 or 15% of people who love their job. Probably like you. You'll probably, even if you didn't get paid for this, you'd still probably do it because you love your job that much, right?
Incorrect.
Okay. Anyway, but there are some people who do love their job.
No, I take
that category. Okay, so put myself in that category. Very fortunate, very blessed. Then the other end of the spectrum, there's another 10 or 15% of the population who hate their job. they not just hate it, they would actively try and take down their organization. That's how bad it is, right?
Right.
Or dislike it, don't like the job. And that leaves about 70% of the population who go to work every single week in the UK. I don't know what your maths are like, but 70% of 30 million people is...
We'll go 20, for 20.
21 million. 21 million who go to work and they neither love nor hate their job. They just do it.
Mm-hmm.
Ambivalent. Apathetic.
Mm.
Do not care. I'm going... You know that book by the Australian nurse? Well, I would hate to get to my later end of my life, 60, 70, 80, if I'm fortunate enough to get there, by the way, because the average life ends about 80, and I know at 42, I'm slap bang in the middle. So if you know how many days there are in a lifetime, there's 28,000 days, roughly. So I've had 14,000 days, Joe, which means I've got 14,000 left.
See, I would, you know, I totally get that. And yet, increasingly, I'm of the opinion a huge percentage of that 21 million don't have too much of an option to radically change their lives. I mean, we can say, no, nonsense, they can. They can go to night school. They can do this. They can do that. But also, lots of them will have the entrapment, without using too strong a word, of mortgage, kids, partner in a certain situation, their own abilities. Like, let's be honest, not all of us have an IQ of 180. Not all of us are equipped to do different things. And sometimes I think the self-help message puts too much onus and blame on the person. Like, if you've read Alan de Botton's Status Anxiety, he talks about, it's really, yeah, really good. So, you know, back in the day, the term for people who weren't doing so well in life was the misfortunates. You know, that was the colloquially, that was the poor misfortunates. Whereas now, and it's something I'm not sure I like, you're called a loser, you know? And the reality is, just by definition, a lot of us will just be average.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Yeah.
So maybe you focus too much on the job. Like, if of that 20 million, if they've got a good home life and they exercise, I don't think it's such a bad outcome if they're a little bit indifferent. I mean, it's not ideal, but like, there's lots of things about the human condition aren't ideal. Is it such a bad outcome if for 40, 50 hours a week they do a job they're a little bit ambivalent towards, and put the rest of their energy into being healthy, enjoying their free time, and just got to suck it up Monday to Friday?
And some people do, and some people do that because they feel comfortable with that. Some people do it and hate doing that. And that's not the point. The point is that doing something because you either want to do it, because you love doing it, or just because you've fallen into it, that's not the point of making. It's all to do with us and what's happening in here. Because why is it that some people who have absolutely everything you could possibly ever want in this life in terms of material goods are some of the most unhappy people you've ever come across?
Mm.
And why is it that some people who have literally haven't got two pennies to rub together are the happiest, most content, most fulfilled people you've ever met?
Mm.
So I'm not talking about their jobs. I'm not talking about their material goods. I'm talking about their mindset and psychology of living the life the way that they want to live.
Mm.
Because whether you do the job you like or whether you don't do a job you like, that's completely irrelevant. It's, are you doing what you think you want to do? Because like you said, how many people have regrets that they weren't true to themselves? And at what stage do you do that? And that's why someone like Gavin Drake, who I mentioned earlier, this is why he's such an inspiration to me, because he was someone who was in a job where he was basically in sales, he was doing okay, wasn't the best, wasn't the worst, just in sales, had a wife, had two small kids, had a mortgage.
Mm.
But he had this kind of almost like nagging idea at the back of his mind that he wanted something better and he wanted to do something different.
Mm.
And I remember he tells me all the time that what happened was he kept saying to his wife, "No, I'd love to start my own business, I'd love to run a training company, I'd love to do this." Until eventually, his wife, they were sitting having a glass of wine one evening, and his wife asked him the question that just completely was a deal breaker. He's like, "If you do it, what's the worst that can happen?"
Mm.
And he just thought, and he was like, "Well, if I leave my job, which is not the highest paid job in the world, but if I leave my job and it doesn't work out, and I go for 3-4 months and I don't get anything in this new company or this new business doesn't work out, I'll just go back and get another job in another place for something similar. And that was 25 years ago. And for the last 25 years, I've never met anyone who is so good at walking their talk, is probably the only way I can explain it. Where, because he talks about the psychology of success and high performers and sort of how to get the best out of yourself, whatever that is, it's like if you're a stay-at-home mum, then it's about how to be the best stay-at-home mum. If you are a grandparent, if you're an athlete, if you're a salesperson, if whatever you're doing, it's about how do you do things that actually, for you, are the right things. Mm. As opposed to all those people who do things, don't really enjoy it, don't really want to do it, but just never do anything about it.
Yeah. I mean, the one irrefutable point in all this, I think, is these are certainly the conversations that we should be having and having more of. You know, I mean, if someone wants to think about it and concludes, ugh, just my lot that I'm not going to like my job, once they've thought it through and it's not just something they're thoughtlessly doing for decades, then I think that's the key thing. So that's how you're spending your time now. You're going around, you're talking to people, you're a keynote speaker effectively. How has it been going?
I love it. I love it, Joe. And again, this is just how fortunate and blessed I feel. The fact that I had, you know, nearly 20 years kicking a ball around and getting paid for it, but basically playing football with my mates. Mm. And that was like best thing ever.
Yeah.
And then for the last 10 years, I'm now traveling around the world, speaking to organizations, talking about kicking a football around. So it's like, it literally couldn't get, I feel like I'm the luckiest guy on the planet. And as my mum keeps saying to me, you know, when are you going to get a real job? I'm like, well, kind of got to this stage and never had a real job, so I'm trying to my best, you know. All my mates in Belfast who blag their way through life and haven't got a real job, I'm like, yep, until he gets one, I'm not getting one.
And what's in your plan then for 10, 15 years ahead?
So I think I've got the kind of the way that my brain works, all those years back, you know, whenever I was 16, 17, reading that book, and I started thinking ahead of, okay, what would I like to see myself in 4 or 5 years' time? What would I like to see myself coming out? And one of the big things whenever I was playing football was I always wanted to write a book. I had no idea what I was going to write it on. I even had the title when I was about 22, 23, A Stupid Footballer Is Dead. I thought, I'd love to write a book, but I have no idea. Then I thought, I'd love to run my own business, but I have no idea what that could be. And I thought, I'd love to be able to travel the world, but I have no idea if I can do that. And all of these things, as the years have gone by, have all gradually evolved. And the only way I can describe it, Joe, is that it probably doesn't happen by chance. Because as I've been going through my life, I've been saying, right, okay, what do I want in my life? What do I not want in my life on a regular basis? So that it doesn't go suddenly 5 years, don't slip past. I'm like, oh, I always wanted to go traveling.
Sure.
Actually, never traveling. Or whatever it is. So the whole point is, because I'm doing this so regularly, it's something that's almost like quite hardwired for me. So now, after 10 years of being a keynote speaker, I'm now at a point where I'm thinking, I feel like I've got a lot of knowledge and experience that now I'm going to start helping, especially athletes or, you know, people in business who want to become keynote speakers. Because I turn up to so many different conferences and events, and I listen to all sorts of different people from, whether it's a sporting background, whether it's a military background, academic background, adventurers, explorers, or just any other range of jobs. And I'm thinking, okay, so there's a lot of people who do keynote speaking, and there's a lot of opportunities. So with my experience, I feel it's about time to start training, especially people who are coming out of careers, that they can come on and do what I've been doing. Because, you know, I've got to say, I had a relatively low profile coming out of football. So like scoring 2 goals in the Premier League doesn't make you a household name. And for the last 10 years, because I went away to America and spent a significant amount of money on doing a keynote speaker training course and came back, and for 10 years, I've pretty much worked my way up through the ranks until last week, I just delivered a keynote for Microsoft. But that's only through blood, sweat, and tears of being able to learn, improve, analyze your performance, you know, get better at what you're doing. And so now at the stage now where I'm at, I'm thinking, okay, let's be able to share this now with more people, because I feel like it's a skill that people would like to have, and people are still, but like, you know, why do people not to come in and think about the yoga mat and ask them questions about it? It's because people are still pretty afraid, pretty terrified when they think about public speaking or keynote speaking.
Listen, Paul McVeigh of Northern Ireland, of Norwich, of the Premier League, and now a completely different career. It's been great chatting to you and hearing about how your life's unfolded. Thanks so much, Paul.
Pleasure, Joe. Thank you very much for having me.
It sure was a super finish. That's November 2012. That is 18-year-old Tony Watts scoring against Barcelona to put Celtic 2-0 up. Celtic Park goes absolutely ballistic, as you might imagine. He's 18 years of age. It's something of a fairy tale. And we wanted to catch up with him all these years later, where he's now playing with Motherwell, or not playing, obviously, as the situation is. Tony Watts, how you doing?
Oh, good.
Thanks for joining us. Thank you for joining us. I mean, it's funny, you're only 18 when you score that. You're still bloody young. You're still playing. You should be only coming into your prime now.
Yeah, no, I'm hopefully settled now with Motherwell. I've only played a couple of games, but obviously due to the COVID, we've had to stop and restart. Hopefully soon, hopefully in August, whenever the guidelines have been eased. But I'm itching to get into it, and I'm hopefully this is a place where I can settle. I'm back home for the first time in a while. I was home with St Johnstone, but it was still a few hours away. Mm. So hopefully this is the first time I can settle for a couple of years.
Is scoring an iconic goal like that? I mean, I didn't watch all of Celtic's Champions League games. I wasn't a Celtic fan. I know lots of Irish people are. But I remember you and I remember that goal. Is that a weight around your neck, or is it just the best thing that ever happened to you?
No, people say it's a weight around your neck. People talk about it. I love doing it. I'm a Celtic fan. Well, I was a Celtic fan. Now, obviously, I'm a Motherwell fan as I play for them. And it's just potential. This is just what other people talk up. I lived my dream and now it's time to move on. And I have moved on many years ago. And as I said, I'm living my dream every day playing as a professional footballer. Motherwell's a club where I actually went to watch Motherwell before I watched Celtic when I was younger. So it's still a dream for me to live close to the club and play for them.
Were you in the mix as an 18-year-old when it came to first-team games? Were Champions League games a feature of your life at that stage, or was this a total freak that you were coming off the bench against Barcelona?
I think that was maybe my first taste of it. I'm not actually too sure. I think it was. But I was in about it. I was on the bench most of the games. I was part of the squad and I was in the first-team picture. I was playing quite regularly.
The goal itself, Xavi makes an almighty blunder. That's what helps. Do you remember it, or do you only remember it via watching on TV? Can you remember it actually experiencing it?
I can remember it more bitty. I can't remember the full process. I can't remember the full action, shall we say. But I remember bits of it. I just remember after it thinking, what should I do? Should I knee slide or not? And then obviously time just goes slow after it. And then, to be honest, it's just bitty. Also, it's 8 years ago. It's not as if it's yesterday. I still can't remember what I was doing last week, never mind 8 years ago.
In total, you made 25 appearances for Celtic. Did that goal change much for you? Did you start getting into the side more? Like, talk to us about your experience at Celtic across those two remaining years that you stayed with the club.
No, I probably played less. After that, I started a couple of games. I never started the next game, and then I started a couple after that, and then I just kind of fell out of the picture, and it was time for me to go, and that's what people probably can't wrap their head around. It's time for me to move on, and I felt fine about that. I felt I'd lived my dream, and I felt it was time to move on, and just being a professional footballer was a dream for me, and it still is. Like I say, every day when I wake up and being able to go to training every day and kick a ball about and get paid for it, it's unbelievable.
Mm. Were you close to the first team? Did you feel like you should have been in the first team around then?
Yeah, that's why I moved on. I felt like I should have. I think that's 25 league games. I played nearly 40 games, I think. And okay. by that time after my game time was limited, and I thought I was good enough to play, so I thought, well, it's better off me moving on rather than sitting on the bench and collecting money.
Mm. Neil Lennon was the manager then. What was your relationship like with him?
Yeah, it was good, especially at the start. He was really fair with me. He gave me a lot of opportunities, and then obviously it got to a time I wanted to leave, and that was that. I wanted to leave. I was quite stubborn about it, and it was it. It was just by the time I went on loan and came back, he was gone. Mm. So it was kind of move on time.
The loan experience wasn't very good.
What one?
The one immediately in the midst of Celtic to, is it Learjah?
Learjah, no, it was fine. It was.
I thought there was an issue with the manager.
There was at the start, but I played a lot of games. I think that was maybe 15, 20 games for a young guy abroad, and I think I got 9 or 10 goals. So I enjoyed it football-wise. It was just one of them that it was tough for me at the start. The manager was tough for me, but I enjoyed it, and it made me more of a man.
When I look through your career, and it's Celtic, and it's the loan move, and then Standard Liège 14-15, Charlton 2015-2017, Cardiff City on loan, Blackburn on loan, Hearts on loan, then the Belgian League 2017-18, then St Johnstone back 2018-19, then Sofia 2019-20, and now Motherwell. Why all the moves?
A lot of the loan moves. First one, Cardiff got a financial fair play. Charlton wanted to sell me. They couldn't do it in the last day. They got a transfer embargo. Blackburn, I ripped my groin off the bone. And then I came up the road to try and get myself right. And then I went back to Charlton. So that's four there. I don't know. I went over to Bulgaria because the offer on the table was brilliant. And after 6 months, I realised sporting-wise, it's better to come home. So that probably explains five or six of them. And as I said, I don't regret it. I'm a young guy, 26, and I've lived a lot of people's dreams, and I'm still living it.
Does it make it hard to find a rhythm as a striker in particular?
Yeah, well, the Cardiff one kind of started it. At Charlton, I was told that they wanted to cash in on me. And I went to Cardiff, and it was a great club, amazing club. And on the last day, they got a transfer embargo, and it kind of made me a bit wary of everything. And then I went to Blackburn, got a Scotland cap, and then the next game I ripped my groin off the bone. So it kind of just started my career stuttering a bit. It just made me a bit not in a flow, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And when I went to Hearts, I came up selfishly just to get back closer to home, and it probably wasn't the right idea. And that's three moves that have just unsettled me in the space of 6 months, 7 months. And that's just that. I've just tried to settle back down, and I was settling well at St Johnstone. Then I got a great offer from Bulgaria. I went over to try it, and I just felt the best thing to do was come back home, and that's me settling now, and hopefully I'll be at Motherwell for a few years so I can just play games and not focus about anything else.
Yeah, it is one of the issues with the job, I suppose, all the moving around and having to develop understandings with new teammates. They know your runs, you know their passes, a certain chemistry, I suppose, and you can look very ordinary or very good, depending on who's around you.
Yeah, that's it. I think there's a lot of respect to everybody that's a professional footballer, because somebody asked me the other day, why don't you slag other footballers when you're streaming or when you're doing that? And I said, well, I've got respect for every footballer because everybody brings their own thing, whether it's hard work, whether it's ability, whether it's passing, all that. It's hard to be a footballer, and confidence. You can gain confidence, it would take months, but you can lose it in a day. And that's just the way it is. And it's a tough job, but we're blessed to be playing it. And I've made decisions for myself, whether it's for my family, for me, whatever. And I think I'm making the right decision staying here, home, and hopefully staying at Motherwell.
When you say you moved away from Celtic, Tony, because you wanted first-team football, was that a good decision in hindsight? I know you're saying, look, you don't regret a thing. And I understand that, and you've seen the world, and you've had good offers. But I wonder, was it a bit of the impatience of youth, you know, hammering at the door, I want to be in, or do you feel you were never going to get in at Celtic?
Well, probably felt at the time I was never going to go in, and I just thought going away and experiencing something else, being out the fishbowl of Glasgow, there's a lot of reasons why I moved, and I don't regret it. Like I said, Glasgow's a small place, especially I became a household name, whether it's rightly or wrongly, but it's just a difficult place to live in, and I just like things my way. I like being relaxed, and I like not having to look over your shoulder every 2 seconds. So it was good for me to get away.
What was it like as an 18-year-old to have that superstardom overnight in Glasgow?
Yeah, it was difficult, but it was also a blessing, because if you'd asked me when I was younger what would I want to do, it would be either scoring for Celtic in the Champions League or scoring in an Old Firm, and that's it. And that's what I wanted to do, and it was a blessing. But at the same time, people say it's a curse, people. But it is what it is. It's something I'll be remembered for, and I'm glad I moved on and I get to test other things out.
So when you were walking around Glasgow, were you just a recognised figure? Everybody knew, oh, that's Tony Watt, he scored the goal against Barcelona, and you found that uncomfortable, you quite enjoyed it. Like, to what extent were you able to walk around Glasgow? Because you used the phrase there that, you know, you'd be looking over your shoulder every 2 seconds.
Yeah, well, it was fine. It was, you always give time back to fans, to people that appreciate you, to people that are nice to you. But again, you want to just go out and not have eyes, and maybe it was yourself being paranoid, maybe, I don't know, but yeah, have eyes on you, and it's just something I wasn't used to. And to be fair, it's not that big a deal. It is what it is, it's part of the job, and it's not a good thing to complain about it, because these people go to the games, these people support you, and these people are the ones that give you the chance to be on that platform.
Who taught you the most about playing up front? Who was the big influence in your career at Celtic?
Well, it was probably when I was younger, the youth team kind of played the similar way to the first team, so you had to get moulded in and press and learn how to press. So probably the youth team coaches, and then everybody put their own stamp on it. I still believe when I went there I was rough, I was raw, and they helped me. They schooled me into being a better player, and obviously a better professional, because I'd went there as a guy who'd never played in the youth academies, and yeah, I might have made mistakes. I probably still make mistakes daily, but they've obviously guided me to make me better and make me improve myself as a player and as a person.
I was doing a bit of reading about you just before we got you on today, and I think it's probably people looking in from the outside, and probably there's an element of looking at all the club moves, and certainly some of the things written about you suggest, is there an attitude problem? That was one of the things I noticed. Is that a fair critique, or is that a misunderstanding and a view from outside? What's your honest opinion on that?
Well, I've never seen anything to back it up, ever, to be honest. A lot of people say it, still never seen anything to back it up. I don't know, it's like me just making up something on the spot and asking you about it and saying defend it. It's not really, not made it up.
Yeah.
But it's like me asking you something, I don't know, I don't really need to defend it, because nothing's came out in the papers, nothing's came out in the press. Maybe somebody doesn't like the way I train, maybe somebody doesn't like the way I speak and train, maybe somebody doesn't like the way I shout at people, if it's to get them going, if it's to get the ball, maybe somebody doesn't, it's just guessing, to be honest. It's just, I try and go in and try and improve every day, and that is what it is. It's people are going to say stuff, not everybody in the world likes you, especially when you're on a platform, like we said. It's, people are always going to take shots at you, aren't they?
Yeah. And to be fair, I didn't see any specifics. I just saw it as sort of out there as opposed to any individual episodes.
I don't know what it is. It's just kind of...
When did that start? Post Celtic, you were about to say.
Yeah, when I was about to leave on loan, it was started creeping out there. And then it kind of stayed out there for a bit. I spoke to Ronnie Dyla before I was leaving, and he said to me, brilliant, you've done everything. I just want to bring my own players in. You've done everything for us that you could have done in terms of proving us your work rate, your attitude. And then in the paper, it was like, it was something that contradicting to that. And
right.
I just thought, that's the way it is in this game. What's the point? Like, defending yourself, what's the point fighting against it? Because my family know what I'm like, my close friends know what I'm like, and the people I've worked with know what I'm like. So I can't really complain, and it is what it is. As they say, sticks and stones will break your bones, but names will never hurt you, will they? And that's just the way it is in football. You'll get a lot of tags and you'll get a lot of stuff said about your reputation, but it is what it is, and it's part of the job.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what you're meant to do as a 21-year-old, to come out and do an interview and say, honestly, I'm a great guy. You know, it's like, address it, not address it. There's not much you can do.
Yeah, you're right. If you follow me on social media, people will show that what I tweet's probably fair. I'm level-headed in terms of I look at stuff from both sides, and I just what's the point of me going out and defending myself to something that it's laughable? I don't remember the last time I caused them any harm. So if that's a bad attitude, then that is what it is. But I don't believe it, to be honest.
So you're 26 years of age now. Tearing your groin off the bone is a massive setback, I suspect. You're still at a point, you know, we get you on and it's Tony Watt and it's, the Barcelona goal. And that's kind of, people remember that. I guess the good thing for you is at 26, you still have 6-7 really good years now where you can redefine how you are remembered. That must be the big ambition for you.
Yeah, well, tearing my groin off the bone didn't just set me back for the 3 months I was injured, 4 months I was injured. I'd never dealt with an injury before. Mentally, it frustrated me. It probably, going back to Hearts, I wasn't in the right frame of mind to get back playing. I should have probably done an all month of rehab. And then that kind of 7-8 months, they say it takes another 7-8 months to get back. And I probably got set back about 18 months. Mm. And then I chose to go over to Belgium, like you say. And it kind of just set me back again. And it was 2 months, 2 years where I had to just say, right, that's it, stop it. And I believe the last 2 years I've been building up to getting back to my best. The last 2 years is probably the most I've played in a while at St Johnstone, Cessica and then Motherwell. I know it's another three clubs, but I believe that that's going to set me up for the last 5 or 6 years of my career and hopefully go and grab as much goals as possible for that time.
And what is your game, Tony? What kind of goals do you score? How do you like to play?
Yeah, I think I'm a traditional number nine. I try and get on the ball and try and link it up, and that's just the way it is. Hopefully I can, as I say, add more goals. I'm looking to score double figures for the rest of my career and see how it goes.
Okay, well listen, thanks so much for taking time to check in. It's great to see that you're back in Scotland and hopefully things go well at Motherwell. Let's talk to you in a couple of years when you've scored 20-30 goals a season a few times over for Motherwell.
No, cheers for having me.
Cheers. Tony Watt there.